And what's going on here, Zayna, with just kind of an impromptu episode of What You Know. I don't have my co-host Harris with me today, but tomorrow I will, and we are actually going to attempt to have a discussion with somebody from the Twitter community. That's going to be a first. As always, you know, low quality, low budget, low tech as we get going. But as has always been the case, our goal is to have conversations with people no matter where they sit on the political spectrum, so long as they're willing to do so. So I've got a few things in the works there. But as I was wrapping up some writing for the day and setting out clothes for work tomorrow and the like, just Sunday evening stuff, I was watching the Dark Horse podcast on my phone with Brett Weinstein and Heather Hain. I always pronounce her name wrong. Anybody who doesn't watch them should check it out. If you don't know anything about Brett, they're both evolutionary biologists and classical liberals. And Brett had, he was the center of the controversy, an attack really from the far, far left, radical left at Evergreen State University, I think in 2015. It's been a while now. But anyway, as I was watching their podcast, Heather starts the podcast with, you know, an open letter. I don't know if it's an open letter so much as a letter. And I'm going to let that play through too. I'm going to try to anyway. And it's called How Woke Activism Took Over Universities and Descended into the Streets, with street riots. And then she reads an excerpt from Catch-22. It's a four-page excerpt, so if you're so inclined, hang in there and bear with us, bear with me as I play it. At the beginning, I have to confess it's been years since I read Catch-22, and I really didn't know where they were going with this. I was starting to wonder, but it very quickly became clear. So let's go ahead and start with her letter, and then she's going to read an excerpt of Catch-22 regarding loyalty oaths, and you'll see how she brings it full circle to what's going on now. And keep in mind, these are two individuals that live in Portland and have said that there's, you know, they don't care what people are saying from the outside of the city, what the media is saying. There's no way you can go downtown and see Portland as a functioning city. So, all right. Let's give this a shot here.
Five paragraphs of this piece, which sets up the reading from Heller that I want to go to next. George Floyd died under the knee of a police officer in Minneapolis in the end of May, and people spilled onto the streets of American cities, outraged at police brutality and racial bias and exhausted by COVID-19 lockdowns. In Portland, Oregon, where I live, those protests turned into riots nearly every single night last summer. The homicide rate climbed to the highest it's been in 30 years. One late night in mid-August, a man was dragged from his car and beaten by a small band of thugs. The next day, on a bluebird sky morning, some of the few stores nearby that were not boarded up had shop owners out on the sidewalks, cleaning up from the mayhem of the previous night. In this once bustling downtown, normal human activity is almost entirely absent while the sun shines. And at night, the chaos resumes. Fires are started, people are assaulted, human feces is literally thrown around. Some would tell you that my mentioning these facts is evidence that I am on the political right. In fact, I am and always have been on the left. Liberalism had many big wins in the 20th century. Securing rights for women, people of color, and workers. The advent of disability law, environmental protections, to name just a few. But there is much more to be done. Even as wealth grows, the middle class is disappearing. Healthcare and education costs climb while quality plummets. And we are polluting our air, water, and soil at unprecedented rates. Extinction rates are rising and habitat is disappearing under the call for more oil, lumber, and spaces for people to live. The gains made by 20th century liberalism and any chance of confronting the big issues still before us are being eroded by a new ideology. This ideology, call it the woke left or the authoritarian left, traffics in blatant falsehoods and untestable claims, and is focused on markers of identity, sex, race, disability, and effectively carves out ways to divide us rather than unite us in our common humanity. We are being told, for instance, that men and women are exactly the same, indeed that sex itself is a social construct. This is a fiction and threatens to disappear many hard-won protections for women. Nature magazine, one of the world's top scientific journals, now inserts into its news stories the claim that sex is neither binary nor fixed. They do this even in articles that are literally about differential outcomes by sex from diseases, including cystic fibrosis and COVID-19. And central to a season of protests that are nominally responding to society-wide racism, we are asked to believe that all white people are guilty of the original sin of racism, for which there is neither cure nor forgiveness. Loyalty oaths are demanded. Admit your racism or be shamed or even fired. If you are not in fact a racist, defending yourself against false claims is itself evidence of your racism. Self-defense is taken as proof of guilt. It's a perfect 21st century Kafka trap. So that's the beginning of this essay that was published a couple days ago in both the glossy hard copy of the Swiss magazine and online. And I was reminded of that piece from it when you mentioned, I think on our last live stream, or maybe it was our private Q&A that we did on Sunday last week.
All right, so I think I'm mistaken. Heather didn't write it herself, but more on that shortly.
That is available to people on my Patreon of the great, it's actually not called the Great Loyalty Oath Campaign, as we had said, it's called the Glorious Loyalty Oath Crusade from Joseph Heller. And this, I will say, this is one of, I hope it's okay that I say this, this is one of the few novels that you have read cover to cover, and I mean, you have actually read a lot, but as someone with a diagnosis that we can discuss separately, whether or not it should be a diagnosis at all, but of dyslexia, you read when you have to, and fiction doesn't necessarily always seem like the thing that's necessary, right?
Well, I love fiction, but I tend to like plays and series and other things.
You like to watch your fiction.
I like to watch the fiction, yeah.
And send it in through your, you know, your eyes and your language.
I still use
apparatus.
My eyes. But, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. this is a four-page excerpt from Joseph Heller's, as I said, Catch-22. I forgot to look at
one. So, if I can just say.
Yeah,
yeah,
please.
This is a book, actually, my mom pointed me to it in high school.
So, originally published in 1955.
1955. My mom, I think, recognizing that I was a little, you know, different. Or something.
Did not everyone in your life notice that?
I guess they did, yeah. And that I had something of a problem with authority.
A
little bit of a problem with authority. Mm-hmm. Thought this book might be just the thing, and it happens that, you know, a lot of it resonated with me quite strongly.
Yeah.
So one of the frustrations that I have is that the book is actually not all that well known in the modern era. People know Catch-22 itself, but they don't
know. The concept, the
right.
Central
They don't
concept.
Even necessarily know what the catch is, but
yeah.
They know.
I should also just pause it there before she begins to say that there's a few books that were mandatory reading when I was growing up, just in the 90s, that should be mandatory reading still, that very few, if not no youngsters, but very few youngsters are aware of. Let's take The Giver, let's take Brave New World, and let's take 1984. All of these books are immensely important and were once part of just the reading list. That is no longer the case.
That a Catch-22 is, you know, it's like a Kafka trap, basically. And throughout the Evergreen episode, I kept wanting to raise this reference because it fit perfectly, but I knew nobody was going to get it.
Wow. That's fascinating. I mean, then this is the problem with the loss of understanding of history, right? And of historical texts. And this, yeah.
Sorry, once again. Well, absolutely. That's a huge problem, especially when part of the Marxist agenda is the erasure of history. So they say up and down, no, that's not what we're doing. That's not what we're doing. That's exactly what they're doing. There's a line in 1984 that I'll paraphrase, essentially. It goes something like, you know, the party can reach back in time and undo history, undo facts, make something different. I'll have to find the exact quote at some point. But that's what we're dealing with now, and they just alluded to it there.
This is not that deep history. This is, what, 65 years ago that published first. And so the central Catch-22 is, if memory serves, if you are sane enough to...
If you're crazy, you don't have to fly. But if you don't want to fly, that's evidence that you're sane.
Yeah, there it is.
You know, and then you're supposed to go... That's some catch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the best there is.
Yeah, which Yossarian in the book is constantly facing things which make him whistle in deep admiration and concern for his and his fellow's lives.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so this is from relatively early in the book, and it just without really any context, I'll just read it, okay? Let's see, I'm sorry, Kitty, you're in the way. I wanted to start with, okay, here. And when someone remarked that Major Major was somewhat odd, Captain Black announced that he was a communist. They're taking over everything, he declared rebelliously. Well, you fellows can stand around and let them if you want to, but I'm not going to. I'm going to do something about it. From now on, I'm going to make every son of a bitch who comes to my intelligence tent sign a loyalty oath. And I'm not going to let that bastard Major Major sign one, even if he wants to. Almost overnight, the glorious Loyalty Oath Crusade was in full flower, and Captain Black was enraptured to discover himself spearheading it. He had really hit on something. All the enlisted men and officers on combat duty had to sign a loyalty oath to get their map cases from the intelligence tent. A second loyalty oath to receive their flak suits and parachutes from the parachute tent. A third loyalty oath for Lieutenant Balkington, the motor vehicle officer, to be allowed to ride from the squadron to the airfield in one of the trucks. Every time they turned around, there was another loyalty oath to be signed. They signed a loyalty oath to get their pay from the finance officer, to obtain their PX supplies, to have their hair cut by the Italian barbers, to Captain Black. Every officer who supported his glorious loyalty oath crusade was a competitor, and he planned and plotted 24 hours a day to keep one step ahead. He would stand second to none in his devotion to country. When other officers had followed his urging and introduced loyalty oaths of their own, he went them one better by making every son of a bitch who came to his intelligence test sign two loyalty oaths, then three, then four. Then he introduced the Pledge of Allegiance, and after that the Star Spangled Banner. One chorus, two choruses, three choruses, four choruses. Each time Captain Black forged ahead of his competitors, he swung upon them scornfully for their failure to follow his example. Each time they followed his example, he retreated with concern and racked his brain for some new stratagem that would enable him to turn upon them scornfully again. Without realizing how it had come about, the combat men in the squadron discovered themselves dominated by the administrators appointed to serve them. They were bullied, insulted, harassed, and shoved about all day long by one after the other. When they voiced objection, Captain Black replied that people who were loyal would not mind signing all the loyalty oaths they had to. To anyone who questioned the effectiveness of the loyalty oaths, he replied that people who really did owe allegiance to their country would be proud to pledge it as often as he forced them to. And to anyone who questioned the morality, he replied that the Star Spangled Banner was the greatest piece of music ever composed. The more loyalty oaths a person signed, the more loyal he was. To Captain Black, it was as simple as that, and he had Corporal Kolodny sign hundreds with his name each day so that he could always prove he was more loyal than anyone else. The important thing is to keep them pledging, he explained to his cohorts. It doesn't matter whether they mean it or not. That's why they make little kids pledge allegiance even before they know what pledge and allegiance mean. To Captain Plitchard and Captain Wren, the glorious loyalty oath crusade was a glorious pain in the ass, since it complicated their task of organizing the crews for each combat mission. Men were tied up all over the squadron, signing, pledging, and singing, and the missions took hours longer to get underway. Effective emergency action became impossible, but Captain Plitchard and Captain Wren were both too timid to raise any outcry against Captain Black, who scrupulously enforced each day the doctrine of continual reaffirmation that he had originated, a doctrine designed to trap all those men who had become disloyal since the last time they had signed a loyalty oath the day before. It was Captain Black who came with advice to Captain Plitchard and Captain Wren as they pitched about in their bewildering predicament. He came with a delegation and advised them bluntly to make each man sign a loyalty oath before allowing him to fly in a combat mission. Of course, it's up to you, Captain Black pointed out. Nobody's trying to pressure you, but everyone else is making them sign loyalty oaths, and it's going to look mighty funny to the FBI if you two are the only ones who don't care enough about your country to make them sign loyalty oaths. If you want to get a bad reputation, that is nobody's business but your own. All we're trying to do is help. Milo was not convinced and absolutely refused to deprive Major Major of food, even if Major Major was a communist, which Milo secretly doubted. Milo was by nature opposed to any innovation that threatened to disrupt the normal course of affairs. Milo took a firm moral stand and absolutely refused to participate in the glorious loyalty oath crusade until Captain Black called upon him with his delegation and requested him to. National defense is everybody's job, Captain Black replied to Milo's objection. And this whole program is voluntary, Milo, don't forget that. The men don't have to sign Plitchard and Rand's loyalty oath if they don't want to. But we need you to starve them to death if they don't. It's just like Catch-22, don't you get it? You're not against Catch-22, are you? Dr. Nico was adamant. What makes you so sure Major Major's a communist? You never heard him denying it until we began accusing him, did you? And you don't see him signing any of our loyalty oaths. You weren't letting him sign any. Of course not, Captain Black explained. That would defeat the whole purpose of our crusade. Look, you don't have to play ball with us if you don't want to, but what's the point of the rest of us working so hard if you're going to give Major Major medical attention the minute Milo begins starving him to death? I just wonder what they're going to think up at group about the man who's undermining our whole security program. They'll probably transfer you to the Pacific. Dr. Nika surrendered swiftly. I'll go tell Gus and Wes to do whatever you want them to do. Up at group, Colonel Cathcart had already begun wondering what was going on. It's that idiot Black off on a patriotism binge, Colonel Korn reported with a smile. I think you'd better play ball with him for a while, since you're the one who promoted Major Major to squadron commander. That was your idea, Colonel Cathcart accused him petulantly. I never should have let you talk me into it. And a very good idea it was, too, reported Colonel Korn, since it eliminated that superfluous major that's been giving you such an awful black eye as an administrator. Don't worry. This will probably run its course soon. The best thing to do now is send Captain Black a letter of total support and hope he drops dead before he does too much damage. Colonel Korn was struck with a whimsical thought. I wonder. You don't suppose that imbecile will try to turn Major Major out of his trailer, do you? The next thing we've got to do is turn that bastard Major Major out of his trailer, Captain Black decided. I'd like to turn his wife and kids out into the woods, too, but we can't. He has no wife and kids, so we'll just have to make do with what we have and turn him out. Who's in charge of the tents? He is. You see? Cried Captain Black. They're taking over everything! Well, I'm not going to stand for it. I'll take this matter right to Major DeCoverley himself if I have to. I'll have Milo speak to him about it the minute he gets back from Rome. Captain Black had boundless faith in the wisdom, power, and justice of Major DeCoverley, even though he had never spoken to him before and still found himself without the courage to do so. He deputized Milo to speak to Major DeCoverley for him and stormed out impatiently as he waited for the tall executive officer to return. Along with everyone else in the squadron, he lived in profound awe and reverence of the majestic, white-haired major with a craggy face and Jehovian bearing, who came back from Rome finally with an injured eye inside a new celluloid eye patch and smashed his whole glorious crusade to bits with a single stroke. Milo carefully said nothing when Major DeCoverley stepped into the mess hall with his fierce and austere dignity the day he returned and found his way blocked by a wall of officers waiting in line to sign loyalty oaths. At the far end of the food counter, a group of men who had arrived earlier were pledging allegiance to the flag, with trays of food balanced in one hand in order to be allowed to take seats at the table. Already at the tables, a group that arrived earlier was singing the Star Spangled Banner in order that they might use the salt and pepper and ketchup there. The hubbub began to subside slowly as Major DeCoverley paused in the doorway with a frown of puzzled disapproval, as though viewing something bizarre. He started forward in a straight line, and the wall of officers before him parted like the Red Sea. Glancing neither left nor right, he strode indomitably up to the steam counter, and in a clear, full-bodied voice that was gruff with age and resonant with ancient eminence and authority, said, "Gimme eat." Instead of eat, Corporal Snark gave Major DeCoverley a loyalty oath to sign. Major DeCoverley swept it away with mighty displeasure the moment he recognized what it was, his good eye flaring up blindingly with fiery disdain and his enormous old corrugated face darkening in mountainous wrath. "Gimme eat," I said, he ordered loudly in harsh tones that rumbled ominously through the silent tent like claps of distant thunder. Corporal Snark turned pale and began to tremble. He glanced toward Milo pleadingly for guidance. For several terrible seconds there was not a sound. Then Milo nodded. "Give him eat," he said. Corporal Snark began giving Major DeCoverley eat. Major DeCoverley turned from the counter with his tray full and came to a stop. His eyes fell on the groups of other officers, gazing at him in mute appeal, and with righteous belligerence he roared, "Give everybody eat!" "Give everybody eat," Milo echoed with joyful relief, and the glorious loyalty oath crusade came to an end.
So yes, for months I harbored the desire to say, "Give everybody eat," and have the madness come to an end. But I knew it would have been lost on everyone.
You did.
All right. So, the loyalty oaths. And there's so much we could pick apart there. But this was just an impromptu episode. The excerpt caught me. And these individuals, being as intelligent as they are, have a great way of juxtaposing something like what you just heard with what's going on in the streets. And as Heather said at the outset, that she is and has been on the left, a classical liberal, her entire life. But she is also reasonable. And there's a big difference between classical liberalism, which is about making people's lives better, and far-left neo-Marxism, which is what she has dubbed in the past read-only activism. In other words, kind of like a read-only document on a computer, read-only software. They're not interested in hearing from anybody else. You're either with us or you're against us. There's no conversation. There's no dialogue. So let's just see. I think they say a couple more words on language, and then we'll close out here.
Don't have the authority to do so.
No,
I didn't. You had not returned from Rome with one eye bandaged and the eminence of a long military career behind you. What we needed was an adult, as we need now, an adult with the eminence and the authority, unfortunately, to come in and say, this will stop.
I wasn't imagining in my wildest dreams that I had the authority to do it, but what I was imagining was that the reference would cause people who were engaged in this loyalty bullshit to recognize what they had become and suddenly become so embarrassed that they would withdraw it. But
and I think I can think of a few people who were privately supportive of us and who were publicly on the fence who for whom that would have caused a pivot. Right? And I think probably in every organization where this is happening, that is true. But is it widespread? Is it widely known enough for it to cause a substantial fraction of people, you know, a population large enough to cause a tipping point to recognize it and to reflect on themselves what they're doing?
No.
I would say no as well. So who's going to be the adult that steps into the room? Or is it going to be just one person? Perhaps there is no answer, but we're certainly at a critical tipping point. That person's not going to be Kamala Harris, and it doesn't seem like, despite my feeling that Trump is an outsider who's doing his best, I intend to vote for him. I think he's governed somewhat conservatively, certainly not in the fiscal sense. We'll continue to rack up astounding debt, which is going to be one of our biggest downfalls. Either that will get us, or this Marxist takeover will get us first, or they'll just be twin forces that bring us down like a controlled demolition. I don't know who that adult in the room is going to be, but we better find that individual soon. Everybody have a safe Sunday, and we'll see you back for an episode of Monday Reboot, where we will hopefully have our guest. Take care.